Is this microphone working? Is this mic? Yep, there it is. Good afternoon. This is Monday, March 18th, the Committee on Health and Human Services and Housing, and it is about 5 minutes to 1 o'clock. We have a quorum. And is Senator Sieben here yet? Not seeing Senator Sieben. I think we'll begin with Senate File 330. Senator Carlson, if you're ready. Good afternoon, Senator Carlson, on Senate File 330.
Madam Chair, and the committee. Senate File 330 is an extremely, extraordinarily simple bill that just extends the ability of certain licensed professionals to order procedures that are within their scope of practice. It's brought to us by the Minnesota Occupational Therapy Association. Yes. And to hear to answer any of your questions and give a little bit more background is Karen Sames from the Therapy Association.
Thank you, Ms. Sames. Please introduce yourself so we get your voice on record. And you're representing the Minnesota Occupational Therapy Association.
Yes, Senator Sharon, members of the committee, my name is Karen Sames, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Occupational Therapy Association, assuming I have a voice. Excuse me. I'm here to urge you to approve Senate File 330, which modifies our licensure statutes for those occupational therapists who use physical agent modalities. Under our current licensure statutes, a physician must order physical agent modalities, what we call PAMs. That's our shorthand for that, before an occupational therapy practitioner can use them. And this bill proposes to replace the word physician with licensed healthcare practitioner practicing within the scope of the licensed healthcare practitioner's license. Licensed healthcare professional. Licensed healthcare professionals are physicians, physician assistants, advanced practice nurses, chiropractors, dentists, and podiatrists. And we believe that this change will streamline access to care and reduce costs for clients who need physical agent modalities. For example, let's say a physician asks her physician assistant to do follow-up care for a person that just had hand surgery. And the physician assistant, following the protocols that were set up, orders occupational therapy to provide physical agent modalities to this patient. And the patient brings that written order to the clinic, and the OT cannot act on those orders currently. The OT would have to contact the physician and get the order directly from the physician. So this bill would simply streamline that process. It's not controversial. We've presented it to the Minnesota Medical Association, the Physician Assistant Association, the podiatrists, even the physical therapists. Nobody's had any objections to this bill. So I urge you to approve Senate File 330.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Sames. Senator Carlson renews his motion to pass Senate File 330 and have it referred to.
I think we have to pass it.
Oh, you're not making the motion.
That's right.
Senator Rosen is making the motion.
Madam Chair, do we have a quorum?
We have a quorum. Oh, yes,
great.
We do.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'd like to offer that Senate File 330 be recommended pass and sent to the floor.
Floor. Yes, sent to the floor. Thank you, Senator Rosen. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion passes. Thank you, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Let's go to Senator Eaton, if you're ready.
I guess so.
This is Senate File 431.
Yes, we made it. Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a bill for licensed dietitian or licensed nutritionist to be able to follow a protocol from a physician for diet purposes. When they did the original bill, they neglected to list dietitians. So,
do you have an amendment?
I believe so. It is one amendment with two technical changes that were caught by the House research.
Thank you. It's Amendment A1. Senator Eaton offers the A1 amendment. It's an author's amendment. This is your first stop, correct?
Yes.
So all those in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
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 Anyone opposed, say nay. Passes. Thank you. And with you, you have someone to testify? Or
yes, thank you. I'm Ann Erickson. I'm with the Minnesota Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics.
Say that again. I did not hear.
Ann Erickson with the Minnesota Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. Sorry about that.
Thank you, Ms. Erickson.
And just to put this in perspective, the House version, the House File 195, did get its hearing on February 27th. No controversy, and it is now at the general register awaiting a vote by the House. So first of all, thank you, Senator Sharon and the committee members, for getting us on the agenda. We really appreciate that. I'm representing about 1,600 licensed dietitians and nutritionists. And as Senator Eaton stated, we are here to correct an oversight with an existing statute. The current statute gives the physician the authority to delegate to physician assistants, nurses, pharmacists, medical residents, and medical students. So the Board of Pharmacy agreed unanimously at their board meeting in December that we should be included. It was completely an oversight as far as their perspective on it. So there are many conditions and treatment specific protocols in healthcare organizations. They are sort of the game plan that pull in the team to coordinate and allow for an efficient delivery of a patient's care plan. So that's where the dietitian, especially when there's a significant nutrition component, is included in the execution of that particular protocol. So one easy to understand example would be diabetes care, where the licensed dietitian or licensed nutritionist works with the patients and the family members to manage the food intake and the insulin within the diabetes management protocol that may include a titration schedule for insulin. But in addition to that relatively easy example, there's many other examples, including total parenteral nutrition, tube feeding, cystic fibrosis, dialysis, and et cetera, where nutrition plays a huge role in the overall management of that patient's care. And as I'm sure everyone recognizes, practice guidelines and protocols really drive this collaborative, integrated approach to healthcare delivery and is so essential for cost-effective care and patient-centered focus. So thank you again for allowing time for us on the agenda today. I'll be happy to take any questions if there are any.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions from the members of the committee? Seeing none, Senator Eaton renews her motion.
For Senate File 431, as amended.
As amended, and it is to move to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Thank you. Senator Eaton, if you want to, we can just continue through the agenda with your bills.
I need to grab a folder.
This would be Senate File 1016. Mm-hmm.
Didn't occur to me to grab both of them when I did. Is this its first hearing?
Senator Eaton, I'm going to take over for a moment. So, please proceed with Senate file number 1016.
I do have an author's amendment, an A1.
Okay. Do we have the author's amendment?
Yes.
Okay. While that's being distributed, do you want to make any comments about the amendment?
Or? My understanding is it's all technical. I don't think anything changes the meaning, or let's see, no, just cleaning up language.
Okay, Senator Eaton moves to amend Senate file number 1016 as on the A1 amendment. Are there any questions? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm pleased to author Senate File 1016, a bill to update the Minnesota Nurse Practice Act. I know this bill has taken many years and countless meetings to complete. The Minnesota Nurse Practice Act was last revised roughly 40 years ago. The proposed changes address the issues of removing barriers, allowing for the evolution of practice, and provides greater clarity. I would like to thank both the RN and LPN advocates and the Minnesota Board of Nursing for facilitating the conversations to make the Nurse Practice Act a document that can explain and grow with the future of nursing. You should have letters of support from the Registered Nurses Union, the Minnesota Nurses Association, the LPN unions, and the Minnesota LPN Alliance. With me, I have Deb Haginson, President of the Minnesota Board of Nursing, and she'll quickly explain the bill and answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. And please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Deb Haginson. I live and work in Park Rapids, Minnesota, and I am an RN member of the Minnesota Board of Nursing, currently serving as president of the board. I'm here with Shirley Brecken, executive director of the board. I'm here to ask your support for revisions to the Nurse Practice Act that are in Senate File 1016. I am excited to be here because language proposed in this bill represents the collaborative efforts of stakeholders across the nursing community to remove barriers and to clarify the scope of practice for RNs and LPNs in Minnesota. As Senator Eaton said, the current Nurse Practice Act language has not changed in over 40 years. This language better reflects current nursing practice and supports nursing practice going forward. The language proposed in this bill is the result of deliberate and extensive feedback from the nursing community. A comprehensive analysis of nursing education and practice identified a need to clarify and differentiate the roles of LPNs and RNs. Following a survey of Minnesota nurses, proposed revisions to the Practice Act were drafted to address areas that lacked clarity and that were seen as potential barriers to the evolution of nursing practice. Feedback from that language was obtained from 32 listening and stakeholder sessions conducted across the state, as well as from written and email comments. In all, over 800 individuals participated in reviewing and providing feedback regarding the draft language. Feedback was obtained from nurses working in hospitals, in nursing homes, in home care, in clinics, in schools, from direct care nurses, from nurse educators, from public health nurses, nurse administrators. Based on the broad feedback received, the revised draft of the Nurse Practice Act revisions was developed. The work was done through the Board of Nursing Practice Committee. Nursing community stakeholders were active participants throughout this work. Most notably, the Minnesota Nurses Association and the Minnesota LPN Alliance regularly attended these meetings and gave input and support for the work. Along with the Board of Nursing, both the Minnesota Nurses Association and the Minnesota LPN Alliance have written letters of support for the proposed revisions to the Practice Act. The role of the board is to protect the public. I believe this language supports that goal by clarifying the roles of RNs and LPNs. It provides clarification for nurses and for employers, and most importantly, it clarifies the nursing roles for the public, who are the consumers of nursing care. I thank you for your time and consideration and ask you to support the revisions to the Practice Act and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. And would your other testifier like to speak at this time?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Shirley Brecken with the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Nursing, and I'm available for questions.
Okay. Members of the committee, are there questions regarding the bill? Senator Sharon.
I really don't have a question, but I just want to emphasize that the fact that there aren't very many questions and that this is moving with the support, I think, so far of the committee, it's an indication of how much work you've been doing. I've been a participant in some of these conversations at the local level, and this has been a long, long, long conversation. And for you to be able to come here today at the table with a negotiated agreement like this is remarkable. It's the way we like to see things worked out before they get to our committee, and we appreciate it very much. So thank you for your very, very hard work.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Do any other members have questions? Hearing no other questions, Senator Eaton, do you wish to renew
my motion to pass Senate File 1016 as amended and move it to the floor.
All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes and is referred to the floor.
Thank you for all your hard work. I just get to take her.
Now we will move to Senate File Number 473, Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. First, I have an author's amendment. If someone wouldn't mind moving for me, I can.
Senator Eaton moves the author's amendment. Is that
the A2 amendment?
The A2 amendment.
And this is the first committee that the bill's been heard in.
Okay. So Senator Eaton moves to amend Senate File Number 473 with the A2 amendment. Are there any questions? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Amendment passes. Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Senate File 473 would require newborn screening for critical congenital heart disease. I actually first learned about this issue from my pediatrician, who, when I had an infant, talked about how he had been working with Regents Hospital to implement this type of screening at Regents Hospital on a pilot basis. And he talked to me repeatedly, because, you know, when you have a newborn, you go to the doctor a lot, about the need for Minnesota to enact a requirement that all newborns be screened for critical congenital heart disease. So the legislation essentially requires hospitals and birthing centers that provide newborn care services to screen for congenital heart disease of all newborns before discharge using pulse oximetry screening. And the results of the screening must be reported to the Department of Health. And that's what's in Subdivision 2. And then essentially the data is used as a resource for providers to develop and implement policies for intervention services and long-term follow-up. So approximately 1 in 100 babies are born with a heart defect, and heart defects are the most common and deadly of all birth defects. And pulse ox screening is easy, painless, non-invasive. I'd like to emphasize that it doesn't collect any tissue or blood sample. And it's done by sticking a Band-Aid-like sensor on the foot or hand of a newborn to measure oxygen saturation in the blood at the extremities. And it costs very little and can detect critical congenital heart defects that, if detected early enough, are treated. And unfortunately, what has been seen is if they're not caught early, then can be fatal. And current methods of physical examination of newborns do not detect all of that needs to be detected. So the pulse ox screening can detect defects that don't present themselves during a physical examination. So here to provide testimony on the bill is Jolene Tesh, the vice president and co-founder of Lasting Imprint.
Thank you, Ms. Tesh. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm here. My name is Jolene Tesh, representing Lasting Imprint and the Minnesota CHD community. On behalf of our community, I want to extend a heartfelt thank you to Anne Marie Saarinen and her daughter, Eve. It is because of Eve's early diagnosis through pulse oximetry that Anna Marie has worked tirelessly to help save other babies through pulse ox. We would also like to thank the Minnesota Department of Health for proactively adding this to the routine uniform screening panel in 2012. This legislation ensures quicker, more effective implementation among the state's hospitals and helps us to know this screening is working. I would like to share with you the benefits of pulse oximetry by sharing our son David's story. On May 21st, 2010, we welcomed our second son, David Duane Tesh. David was born a seemingly healthy baby weighing in at 8 pounds and 12 ounces. He had good color. He successfully nursed several times, but after birth and in the late hours of his birthday and early morning hours that followed, I began to question the nurse that something didn't feel right. For 6 hours, I was unable to get him to nurse again. He was sleepy, his hands and feet were cold, and his breathing was fast and shallow. This wasn't anything like what I remember with our first child, and each of my concerns was quickly dismissed by our nurse. I requested that she take him to the nursery so I could rest and asked that if he started to show signs of hunger for him to be brought back. What seemed like only minutes later, the same nurse entered our room to tell us David had been moved to a level 2 nursery for observation. Trying to think about anything else in the coming hours was impossible. We sat in a state of disbelief and wondered what could possibly be wrong. The level 2 nursery came in to tell us that something was seriously wrong with David, and he was being transported to Children's Hospital via LifeLink. She told us we should come say our goodbyes now, as they did not want to delay his departure once LifeLink arrived. I remember entering the level 2 nursery and slowly walking by each of the pink babies under warmers, only to have my eyes finally rest upon our son, completely and totally in shock and horror of what I saw. While we went crazy waiting to be discharged from the hospital, the medical staff at Children's Hospital was able to quickly diagnose with our son with having several complex heart defects: aortic stenosis with thickened restrictive leaflets, coarctation of the aorta, an underdeveloped left ventricle, and an underdeveloped mitral valve, commonly known in combination as hypoplastic left heart syndrome, and addressed here today as a critical congenital heart defect. David entered into respiratory failure, congestive heart failure, and acute renal failure. Because of his late diagnosis, David spent nearly a month of his life in the NICU, allowing his organs time to recover and to lose the nearly 4 pounds of fluid his body had retained from being in kidney failure. He had one open heart surgery and many other procedures in the 2.5 months he was in the hospital. And on August 10th, 2010, we were finally able to bring David home. The idea was to allow David's organ continue time to heal and for him to get bigger and stronger. It was a joyous day and one that our family was under one roof, and it's a day that we will always remember. After 24 hours of being at home, David took his last breath while napping. My attempts to revive him were unsuccessful, and in his autopsy report, it was evident that due to lack of oxygen, his organs sustained significant irreversible damage. We are so proud that we got to call him ours, even if that time was far too short. It was his life and death that I needed to honor. In February of 2011, I left my decade-long career as a patent paralegal, and in March of 2011, helped form a Minnesota nonprofit called Lasting Imprint with a group of women. Initially, we offered support and connections and began a fierce effort in educating communities about the number one birth defect in America through public speaking engagements and events. Lasting Imprint quickly realized there was much more that needed to be done in our CHD community. Since then, we have been able to facilitate educational trainings for medical professionals to more accurately diagnose congenital heart defects prenatally. We've begun to build strategic partnerships with those organizations that will help make a bigger impact for our health of our CHD warriors now and in the future. Despite numbers like 40,000 babies born every year with a CHD, or that 4,000 of them will not live to see their first birthday, no one ever stops to think that they might have a child with a congenital heart defect. In Minnesota alone, we have more than 600 newborn infants born every year with a congenital heart defect. That's two babies every day. And sadly, one of them's not going to be diagnosed prenatally. That baby has a 1 in 3 chance of leaving a nursery with an undiagnosed critical congenital heart defect. Pulse oximetry is potentially life-saving for these infants. Those in our CHD community know the best case scenario is to have a diagnosis prior to delivery for optimal care after birth. Early diagnosis reduces the number of mortalities and costs associated with delayed diagnosis, including surgical compromise, neurological impairments, developmental delay, organ failure, and long-term feeding issues. Every day, we see the faces of the children that pulse oximetry could have saved. It is a simple, non-invasive, inexpensive, and accurate test, and it's the best way to ensure the best outcome for babies. If a nurse changed your child's diaper, would you think anything of the cost? The pulse oximetry test costs less than a diaper change. And when you're at the hospital holding that brand new baby that forever stole part of your heart, once you want to make sure that you're giving them the best start to their life, although I desperately wish that no parent would ever have to go through what our family has, the deeper wish is for the voiceless babies that I never want to see this suffer the same way our son did. If pulse oximetry is performed on all newborns and you have saved one life, wouldn't it be worth it? If pulse oximetry was done when David was here, it's a very real chance that he would be with us today. Thank you for your time, committee, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for, please accept our extension of sympathies on your loss, but thank you for the work that you're doing to advance the well-being of other children who might be suffering from this disease. Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd also like, if I could have a page, please distribute this. There are comments from Representative Nick Zerwas, who is carrying the bill in the House, and wanted members to see his testimony. He was born with a critical congenital heart defect and wanted actually to testify here, but since we don't generally allow that in the Senate, we thought he could distribute his comments.
But with that, distributed. Thank you, Senator.
Sure. I'm happy to stand for questions on the bill.
We do have another person that asked to testify today, Senator. It's Twyla Braze. Is she here? I didn't see her come in. Okay, thank you, Senator Sieben. Without other testifiers, we will bring it in and take questions. Senator Eaton.
I actually wanted to move the bill.
Move the bill. Senator Eaton moves Senate File 473, and that it be passed and referred to Judiciary.
As amended,
please. As amended. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Passes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, committee members. And
yes. Thank you, Senator, and thank you, Ms. Tesh.
Thank you.
Senator Hayden, yes, please. Senate File 471.
Yeah, you're fine. Thank you, Madam Chair. We have Senate File 471, the Standards of Care Act. And, Madam Chair, I think I do have an author's amendment in. Also, Mr. I mess up his name all the time. Also, have some oral amendments to that.
Labago.
I'm sorry.
Staff.
Is this a delete all amendment, did you say?
Yes, ma'am.
Senator Hayden. Senator Hayden offers the A6 delete all amendment to Senate File 471.
Hold on a second,
And there is an oral amendment to your delete all.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Labago.
Should I wait?
Oh, go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, on page 2, line 4, strike qualify and enter quality. Page 2, line 27, after the word outcomes, insert a period. And then insert, in making the recommendations, comma, the commissioner must examine.
Sorry. Most of us didn't have the amendment yet, so. We could hear, most of us didn't have the amendment yet, Madam Chair?
Yes, Madam Chair.
So if we could repeat it.
Okay, well, the oral amendment to the, okay, we're going to repeat the oral amendment.
Madam Chair, members, on page 2, line 4, strike the word qualify and insert quality. And on page 2, line 27, after the word outcomes, insert a period, and then insert, in making the recommendations, comma, the commissioner must examine. And on page 2, line 28, delete the word study and insert studies. Page 2, line 29, delete the word qualify and insert quality. And page 2, line 33, delete the number 3 and insert the letter D. So it'll be a new paragraph, and the other paragraphs will be reordered. And page 2, line 32, so one above, delete the word and. And what we'll do, there'll be some other technical changes to format it properly. I can go ahead and do that. And then finally, on page 2, line 34, after the word data, insert in paragraph C. And then again on the next page, page 3, we'll just reorder the paragraph. So line 1 will be E as in, instead of D, and line 4 will be F instead of E.
Senator Eden, you move the amendments to your delete all amendment, and including the permission for the technical changes to be made by staff. Do you agree to that?
Yes,
motion?
I agree to that, Mr. Madam Chair.
Senator Hayden moves the motion to amend the A6 delete all amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Passes now on the A6 delete all amendment. I think that you would like us to adopt that, and then you'll explain that to us?
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
Is that your preference? Okay. So on the A6 delete all amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Passes. Senator Hayden.
Well, Madam Chair, Senate File 471, the Standards of Care Act, the bill requires the hospitals to do three things. It's a condition of their licensure. Create a staffing plan that reports, amongst other things, the number of hours of direct patient care, We also ask the hospitals and direct care nurses to communicate with each other about staffing needs. There's a consumer transparency section that asks the hospitals to post information on the Minnesota Hospital Association's quality report website. And finally, Madam Chair, we are requesting a study that looks at the safety and quality of care for patients as it relates to nursing staffing. Madam Chair, I have Shannon Cunningham here from the Minnesota Nurses Association to give you a more thorough, detailed look at the bill.
Ms. Cunningham, thank you. Introduce yourself and who you represent.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Shannon Cunningham, and I am with the Minnesota Nurses Association.
You'll be going through the bill?
Absolutely. And so please stop me if it's too detailed, but I thought I would just go over each line and kind of explain it. Obviously, Section 1, Standards of Care, Title, Subdivision 1, Condition of Licensure, just makes the requirements of this bill a condition of licensure for hospitals. Subdivision 2, Hospital Staffing Plan and Report. Essentially, what this does is requires hospitals to develop a core staffing plan for each patient care unit and then submit that plan to the Commissioner of Health. We ask that that staffing plan do a couple different things. One, indicate the number of direct patient care hours per patient, per unit, and per shift based on two shifts of 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. and 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. We also add number two, which is basically an acuity measure, which would require them to include measures that differentiate between the severity of patient illness, readmission rates, length of stay, and other things that are related to acuity. B would say, prior to submitting the core staffing plan, hospitals will need to consult with direct care staff nurses and other members of the care team. And we sort of leave that up to the hospitals. They can consult with the people who are on this list, but as well with additional people. Subdivision 3 relates to consumer transparency. We ask that every Minnesota hospital provide on an infrastructure that already exists, which is the Hospital Association's Hospital Quality Report website, that they provide on a quarterly basis the following: the actual number of direct patient care hours per patient per unit per shift based on, as stated above, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. and 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. shift. We also ask that they submit details or changes to the hospital's core staffing plan, including factors listed above, as well as statistics as defined by the National Quality Forum on the following staffing-related outcomes that you can see are listed. All of these outcomes are things that have previously been linked to staffing levels based on evidence-based research. We also just put in Subdivision B that the information shall be required to be displayed in a consumer-friendly format and ask that the Minnesota Hospital Association confer with the Nurses Association or others requiring accurate and appropriate display of those staffing plans on that website. Subdivision 4 relates directly to the study and asks that the commissioner study the safety and quality of care for patients in Minnesota hospitals as it relates specifically to the adequacy of nurse staffing and patient outcomes. We ask that the study report the actual number of direct care patient hours, again, per unit, per shift, based on two shifts of 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. and 7 p.m. to 7 a.m., and also complete a comparison of commonly used acuity tools in Minnesota hospitals. Based on that, we ask them to develop sort of a common definition of patient acuity and include this in the study results so that we are able to see how each of those staffing levels is related to both acuity and nurse staffing. And then 4, review relevant quality statistics in Minnesota hospitals proven to be sensitive to nurse staffing as defined by the National Quality Forum, including but not limited to the things that were listed previously. We also ask the commissioner that or allow the commissioner to convene a work group that includes the Hospital Association, the Nurses Association, and other stakeholders to assist with the study and provide input. And then we ask that the commissioner make recommendations regarding the collection of standardized data concerning the linkage between staffing and quality of care, including patient outcomes. we ask that the department, that do an ongoing study of the relationships between nurse staffing in hospitals and quality of care, and look at mechanisms to obtain relevant licensure and demographic data that may be available from other state agencies, just to ensure that the study is as well-rounded as possible. And then the new Section D says the commissioner shall collaborate with hospitals and the nursing profession with respect to the collection of this data concerning patient care outcomes and make the data available in a report card format. The report shall be presented to the governor and the chairs and ranking minority members of the committees and divisions in the Senate and House with primary jurisdiction over Health and Human Services policy and finance. And then the commissioner must use existing funds to complete this study. Basically, that is the walkthrough of the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Cunningham. Senator Hayden.
Well, Madam Chair, I think we have a couple of testifiers that we'd like to come up, and I think that there may be a few people in the room that may have a different view of how this bill should work, so we want to make sure we leave time for them.
And we will. Senator Hayden, we have a Walter Fredrickson from the Minnesota Nurses Association on our list. Is that one of the persons that you're inviting to testify?
Yes,
Mr. Walter Fredrickson?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Are you going to read through all of that, sir?
No.
It reminds me just to indicate that we have listed here at least six persons. I'm not sure that represents everyone that wants to be heard on the bill. I'm going to say the names out loud right now. Walter Fredrickson, Bernadine Engeldorf, Mary Turner, Mr. Lawrence Massa, Ms. Diane Tweddle, Dr. Brent Asplin. Those are the names we have on the list. Is there anybody else that's here that's wishing to be heard? Okay, thank you. So those are the six testifiers, and I'd like you to keep your comments then to about a little under 4 minutes, because it will allow us time to have a conversation as a committee and discuss this thoroughly and ask questions. So with that, would you introduce yourself?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Walter Fredrickson. I've been a licensed registered nurse for 38 years in the state of Minnesota, and I am currently the executive director of the Minnesota Nurses Association. My colleagues and I are here because of the concern about patients that we care for in hospitals. 20,000 members of MNA have been filling out forms identifying these concerns over staffing levels for years. In fact, I've brought forms from just the past year, which 3,300 of them. So there's a few more in the box, and I won't read them to you. Many of these situations occur on a daily basis, happening even prior to coming onto a shift. Many times it's an occurrence that patient acuity is too high, there's inadequate staffing by nurses who are under-orientated or don't have the experience. A lot of times these staffing shifts start even lower than the hospital's asserted core staffing levels. We believe the patients are unknowingly in the hospitals, consumers of health care, unknowingly that they are at risk in the place that they're getting cared for. A lot of this goes unnoticed because of the great work of the registered nurses of Minnesota. They bond together, they work together, they make stuff happen. And of course, they're not talking to the patients about how bad the staffing is. If that was the case, it would probably be a public crisis. We know that the hospitals currently claim to have high quality care, which I'm sure they do, but I'll again say it's because of the registered nurses working in them facilities. They've yet to figure out a way to run a hospital without nurses. Let's put it that way. There's been many studies that show that adequate nursing staffing helps patient outcomes. It improves length of stay, infection rates. It improves healthcare dollars. It's more effective. In fact, I've yet to see a study yet that showed that less nursing care provided better outcomes. We understand this, the problem requires a Minnesota solution. That's why we believe the first step in addressing the problem is greater transparency for patients who are the consumers of healthcare in Minnesota hospitals. Patients are entitled to this information even prior before going to a hospital. Many nurses feel that this information should be transparent and available to all the consumers. Patients should also know how often staffing-related occurrences occur in facilities, preventable occurrences like infections, falls that nurses know, and studies show that are preventable outcomes and occurrences with proper staffing. Finally, we believe the Minnesota Minnesota Department of Health should study the data that hospitals report and make recommendations about how nurse staffing and patient outcomes are linked. And because nurses know that patient acuity matters, we think the Department of Health should study the different acuity models that exist and determine a common definition that everyone can understand, including the consumers. Every patient deserves this transparency when it comes to being a consumer of health care without exception. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Fredrickson. Bernadine Engeldorf, followed by Mary Turner. Mary, you could come up to the table.
How are you?
Please introduce yourself.
Hi. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bernadine Engeldorf. I'm a registered nurse. For 30-plus years, I don't always say how many anymore. Thank you for this opportunity to shed some light on our concerns or the concerns nurses have for our patients in our hospitals today. I speak in strong support of the Standards of Care Act because I have personally witnessed and as an elected leader of my union at United Hospital have received too many of the reports, as some of them noted on your desk today, from colleagues when patients are at risk because not enough nurses are on duty. I do work in mental health, and there are times when my professional abilities are divided among too many patients, and the result can be heartbreaking and tragic. Imagine being confused, psychotic, scared, and in an emotional state, and then being left alone while your caregiver is called away to attend another an emergency. As much of as our networks of hospitals claim safety as their primary goal, nurses believe there is a crisis in patient care in Minnesota's hospitals today, and that our patients are at risk. We witness suffering, real wasted health care dollars, and real emergencies that are preventable. Often our employers make a decision not to fill the holes in the schedule sheet or replace the nurse who quit last month. Hospitals' claims of safety mask a precarious workplace with errors and near misses. Patients suffer, and yes, there are some negative consequences because we are taking care of three patients, even though our standards, knowledge, and ethics tell us one patient needs our exclusive care. A hospital will say there is safe staffing because all the patients have a nurse. I say we have staffing hoping that nothing major goes wrong on a shift. We also have a crisis in communication. We can inform our managers of distress regarding not enough nurses, and often we fail to get a response. More often we get an inadequate response, like, I can't manufacture a replacement nurse. There is nobody. What can we do? You shouldn't call in sick. We submit reports of unsafe staffing situations where a tragedy would have happened if not for nurses overcoming systemic obstacles. As Mr. Fredrickson indicated, we do believe that nurses find a way to make it happen and to keep patients safe. You are admitted to a hospital or an acute care setting for one reason, and that's for nursing care. Of course, you may be there for a surgery or procedure, but if you did not need nursing care post-procedure or surgery, you would go home. We have effectively reduced patient stays, and you do go home sooner, but that only means you are much more acute while you're in the hospital. To remain safe, we must assure there is the right number of nurses to the right number of patients. We need to be assured of that standard level of care. My accountability to you is one based on licensure, a professional one based on scientific evidence, and an ethical one based on a code and a pledge. The Standards of Care Act simply adds another level of accountability in the healthcare setting to give you and your loved ones greater assurance when you entrust us with your care. I appeal to you to support this bill in its full measure. Yes, we need to give patients yourself the benefit of accountability and transparency through reporting and data gathering. Please give us a workplace like the airlines and public safety arenas that adhere to a foundation of staffing standards everyone can count on. Please support the Standards of Care Act you have before you. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Engeldorf. Ms. Turner.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Turner, and I work as a registered nurse in the Twin Cities. Nursing is a second career for me, but it has become my primary passion in my 18 years of practice in acute care. However, I have learned an inside secret. We are rationing health care at the bedside. It doesn't matter to me what the motives or the driving forces are for these decisions that are made at the corporate level. All I know is that at the point of care, in the middle of the night, my colleagues and I have to make heart-wrenching choices between vulnerable people who trust us and need us. I work in the trauma neuro intensive care unit. When you or your loved ones is in intensive care, you are the sickest of the sick. And in today's circumstances, if you are in intensive care, you are much, much sicker than you were 10 years ago. But did you know staffing has changed in the ICU in the last few years? We sometimes are responsible for 2 and 3 patients at a time. The intensity of my job has increased tremendously, and I'm very worried about you. I'm also just as concerned for your family. I remember my first trauma admit and will never forget the horror, fear, despair, anger, and sorrow that I saw on the faces of those family members as they came in and first viewed their loved ones. I was overwhelmed with this onset of emotions layered onto my responsibility of being entrusted with the immediate medical needs of my patient. Today, I'm more adept at juggling the multiple roles a nurse faces of comforting, teaching, and reassuring patients and families. It comes with the assignment. We are a liaison for the patient, the family, and the hospital, attending to not only the physical care of the patients, but to the emotional, spiritual, and psychological needs of the families. You see, we can't tweak healing. Healing doesn't follow a productivity model. Healing takes time and skilled nursing care. And in my ICU, we are getting dangerously scarce on both. In addition to not plugging the gaping holes in our schedules, our management depends on other gimmicks to skirt the issue, like floating nurses from one part of the hospital to another. So now you're sick, you have complex needs in a unit that has a unique layout and protocol, and you have a nurse who is barely orientated to the space, let alone your particular needs. In introducing this bill last month, Senator Hayden stated he believed nurses in our claims, that a problem of patient care exists in our hospitals. For your own sake, for the sake of anyone who has to be admitted to a hospital, please believe Senator Hayden. Believe the millions of Americans who have named nurses the most trusted professionals in the U.S. for the last 10 out of 11 years. Believe your gut. The reports and the studies will bear us out. We need standards of care to save time, money, and lives. Thank you.
Thank you. May I ask,
Ms. Turner, may I ask you a question? One of the things that in the course of the last several years that we've talked about whether we should have ratio bills or not, and what the nurses have been talking about is concerns about the safety of and the well-being of their patients. One of the things that we'll hear as this progresses is a discussion of the measures of safety in our institutions and how we're performing on those measures as an indication of whether or not this is a concern or not. The staffing levels are a concern. I hear this often in the visits that I have in my office, that we have continual improvement in the number of falls, the number of ventilator-acquired infections, that the markers of quality care are good in our hospitals, and that's how we ought to measure whether or not the administrative practices are being responsive to patient needs. And that measure, you know, how do we measure this if it isn't against a set of measures such as patient outcomes? And if those are performing well, or are you challenging that those are not performing mm-hmm. well? And I don't need to lay that on you alone, Ms. Turner. I just thought of it as a result of your testimony. Right. If there's somebody else that would prefer to respond to that, it'd be fine.
My name is Bernadine Engeldorf, registered nurse, Minnesota Nurse Association, Madam Chair and committee members. I have been involved at my hospital in varied committees that evaluates data collected to measure our quality outcomes against the very things you're talking about. There is a risk in the hospitals, as shown by the evidence, that the quality is not necessarily 100% where we would want it in relationship to falls, ventilator-acquired pneumonias, et cetera. It is a continuous and ongoing effort. So there are times where there is direct correlation and evidence to support that staffing probably does impact a negative quality. And that indeed we do need to measure against something. And I think that is one of the things that we as an organization and a nurse group would like to see, that there is evidence and that we do evaluate what are quality measures and is there a direct correlation to staffing numbers or not, and to be able to support that evidence. We believe there is. I don't know if that exactly answers the question you asked.
Well, I'll just follow up with one, Ms. Fredrickson. Engeldorf. That's Mr. Fredrickson in the back. I understand the discussion about the relationship between outcomes on measures and staffing levels, that's an interest of yours and of this legislation to have measures related to that. But if you simply talk about overall measures of an institution's ability to provide safe care, and you use measures such as ventilator-acquired infections or decubitus ulcers or falls or infections of any sort that are acquired while in the hospital, if you have a set of measures that you're following, deaths, I suppose, that are because of error, wrong procedure, wrong sided, all of those things that we measure in the hospital. And if our outcomes based on national standards are very good, which is what I think we're going to hear, you know, when we talk about this, why should we ask for something specific related to nursing staffing if the outcomes are demonstrating that whatever the administrative process is in place for providing care seems to be creating positive outcomes?
So I think that is the question. Are they creating positive outcomes to the level that we could anticipate in our hospitals in Minnesota? Could they be better? So we may have a level of quality outcome that meets 70% of the 100% desired. Do we not want to see that additional 30%? So it's not to say that there may be some quality outcomes being met at this point in time. Could they be better, different? We see evidence of quality outcomes in my particular facility, and they're not And they're defined in red light and red, green, and yellow. And I think everybody does that now. Red is we haven't met. Yellow is we have room for improvement. And green is we're there. We aren't all that green. So I think it is important that we continue to measure against quality. And we are saying we do know that there's national studies that do indicate that the quality is improved with even going up by one registered nurse on a unit or one less patient to a registered nurse. The quality increases by a specific percentage, and it depends on which clinical area you're in. But we do have that evidence in national standards right now, or studies and research right now.
Okay, we'll just continue now with our testifiers. Excuse me for the interruption. Mr. Lawrence, I should be able to say your last name. Massa. President and CEO of the Minnesota Hospital Association. And then that'll be followed by Ms. Diane Tweedle.
Tweedle.
That's why I hesitate here.
Madam Chair, and
if
members
of the committee. If she is here, she could approach the table.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lawrence Massa. I'm the President and CEO of the Minnesota Hospital Association. Let me be clear that we are appreciative of the author and the Minnesota Nurses Association for moving away from a bill that would set staffing quotas in Minnesota's hospitals. We have believed from the beginning that that was bad public policy. It would result in tremendous unintended consequences. However, we do not support the current amendment before you. Let me be clear that we do not believe we have a quality or safety problem in Minnesota hospitals, as evidenced by multiple independent quality organizations. Minnesota is continuously in the top 10 or top quartile of healthcare quality. The Federal Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality ranked our state number one for overall healthcare quality. On behalf of our members, I take issue with the characterization of a patient safety crisis. It is simply not true. Of course, hospitals know that good staffing is important to achieve high quality scores. We believe we provide good staffing in Minnesota's hospitals, but it's not just limited to RN staff. It's the whole care team that impacts the care and outcomes for patients. The language in the proposed amendment, much of that language was shown to us last Thursday and was rejected by the Hospital Association. It was not included in the amendment that was adopted in the House that was authored by Speaker of the House, Thiessen. And so we continue to object to that language. We believe that it's overly prescriptive and burdensome. Hospitals already report numerous quality measures at the state and federal level. You are all familiar with provider peer grouping. Those reports will be coming out later this year that measure hospitals based on overall cost and quality. We have been a champion of reporting and transparency. We have championed the adverse events reporting law in our state. And I would also point out that that report, when you discuss it with the Minnesota Department of Health, less than 1% of the root causes of adverse events is related to staffing. Our members are actively engaged in quality improvement work through the Federal Partnership for Patients. Over 100 of our hospitals are participating with the MHA, with CMS at the national level to reduce all types of hospital-acquired infections and conditions. And so we believe that the current amendment that is proposed is unnecessary.
Before you go forward, would you repeat something? Because I didn't quite understand what you were saying about the language being presented in the House, and then you were talking about the Speaker, and I didn't quite follow along. So if you don't mind repeating.
Madam Chairman, much of the language that's in the proposed amendment before you was shown to us Thursday night by the Minnesota Nurses Association. We did not agree to it. We rejected that language for the reasons that I articulated earlier. Speaker Thiessen did not include that language in the amendment that he offered on the House. He included some of the language that we offered, some of the language that the nurses offered. So this is back to where the nurses started from. with much of the language. There are some changes. We would also argue that, a nurse, as a condition of his or her licensure, is obligated to report any unsafe situation. And our hospitals work with our nursing staff, with all of the caregiving staff, to try to resolve situations immediately. The safe staffing reports that concern for unsafe staffing reports that were mentioned by Mr. Fredrickson, many of the times we don't even see those. They're not provided to us. They're provided internally in the hospital, certainly not provided prospectively so that we have the opportunity to address those. And I believe Ms. Twiddell will speak to how we deal with those kinds of situations. But going back to my earlier point, nurses, as a condition of their licensure, are obligated to report unsafe conditions. A complaint can be made to the Board of Nursing or also to the Board or to the Minnesota Department of Health, Office of Health Facilities Complaints, which would be required to investigate. Hospitals can lose their federal Medicare funding if they do not meet 600 conditions of participation for participating in Medicare, and that includes having adequate and safe staffing in the hospital. If nurses are not reporting these conditions and situations, then we really have a hard time understanding their arguments regarding safety.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hayden.
I just want to make sure that we're clear that the original bill, the bill that I have before you, the amendment, is far different than the original bill that actually created a super committee and actually put some, some numbers, some actual ratio numbers to the bill. So we are far different there. I think that what was talked about is last week in the House, Speaker Thiessen, along with Representative Atkins, the bill author, and others, kind of sat down and kind of created language that this is based on. And I think that that's what the Hospital Association said, that they didn't care a lot for that. The bill passed in the House. We then added some language to be more prescriptive, and that's what's for you today. I just wanted to, because I know you were trying to, at least I was, trying to track kind of how that worked, but I want to say that this is a far different bill than the bill that was originally introduced this session.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. Please introduce yourself.
Hi. Good afternoon. I'm Diane Twiddell, and I've been a registered nurse for 32 years and have worked at Mayo Clinic for 26 years. I am the chief nursing officer for the Southeast region of the Mayo Clinic Health System. And I am here to talk to you today about this bill and why Mayo Clinic Health System and Mayo Clinic are opposed to this bill. As Mayo Clinic, we use an acuity-based staffing system that depends upon the experience, professional judgment, and critical thinking of the bedside RN to assess patient care needs. This works by having registered nurses evaluate individual patient needs for nursing care using professional assessment skills of their patient's condition. Based on these inputs, our acuity system is, they enter into the acuity system three times a day, all the information about the patient assessment, and it allows charge nurses to develop unit-specific reports to determine the staffing needs for each shift. This system allows us to understand the complexity of our patients, to appropriately use RNs, and effectively allocate nursing staff to safely meet patient care requirements. We really believe this proactive approach is successful in providing high-quality nursing care, enhanced patient satisfaction, and nursing staff satisfaction. This approach allows us to determine current staffing needs as well as to anticipate future staffing needs and staff schedules. This is where healthcare is moving today, meeting the individual needs of our patients. We often see, we try to staff, being a nurse leader, I can tell you that we staff to the best of our ability every day of the week. However, we schedule for a typical day and an atypical day happens. An ice storm overwhelms our emergency room with car accidents or falls. Desperately sick flu victims need immediate attention. What do? We call in nurses. We empower our nurses and every caregiver to notify managers of staffing needs, and we respond. Minnesota has some of the highest quality scores and the highest quality care in the country at a low cost. The respected Federal Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality ranks Minnesota as having the best overall healthcare quality in the nation.
with hospitals contributing to the number one ranking. Minnesota already is ranked in the top quarter of states for its quality of health care and affordable cost, and according to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, on an average, Minnesota hospitals are 9% less costly than their national counterparts while maintaining high quality. I've spent my entire career in healthcare. I'm a registered nurse who cares passionately about the profession of nursing. I'm a nurse who is absolutely committed to delivering the best care for every patient, every day, and I urge you to reject this approach.
Ms. Tweddell or Mr. Mesa, as Senator Hayden said, the original bills that were put in front of us were ratio bills rather than acuity-based staffing proposals that determined a ratio against a national standard. This bill does not require the ratio any longer and is not, as I understand it, eliminating the option of acuity-based nurse staffing. So can you heighten for me, at least, what it is about the delete all amendment that doesn't go back to the ratio that is language that you're specifically objecting to here that interferes with what it is you think is in best practice?
As I Madam Chair, members of the committee, as I indicated before, we believe the delete all amendment before you is far too prescriptive, is administratively burdensome. The notion of calculating direct patient hours on two shifts, 7 to 7, 7 to 7, is not how hospitals typically staff. They staff in varieties of shifts, sometimes 8-hour shifts, sometimes 12, sometimes 10. This makes some arbitrary changes to that. The also under the transparency argument, article in subdivision 3, it notes that statistics defined by the National Quality Forum on the following staffing-related outcomes. We believe that two of those that are listed, incidence of cardiac arrest and number of strokes, are not part of the NQF reporting recommendation. So we think there's some issues with the language. We much prefer the language that was adopted in the House that's much more flexible.
So the Madam two Chair. Areas of objection are the shifts that the reporting on the staffing levels on two shifts and the standards that you're two of the standards those that are being
just,
utilized.
Those are just, Madam Chair, members of the committee, those are just a couple of our objections to that, to the broader language.
And my discussion was really focused on, I think that our staffing that we do every day is very reflective of the excellent high quality scores that we have. I think that our staffing mechanism that we use, particularly in my system, I believe is very strong, and I think that's what actually helps us get to those high quality indicators.
I guess the question I have for you is that what I think this legislation in this ongoing debate that's been around for a long period of time is an offering here in this language or in House language to do some transparency around and finding a way in which you can articulate what the staffing levels are, do a study in relationship to the outcomes and the actual safety measures. It is to challenge by making transparent some information about staffing levels against reports of problems or errors so that you can prove that the problem is not there or the Nurses Association can prove that it is. I think that's the dynamic that we're here now. We're not at the staffing ratios anymore. It's to provide a process in which information can be gathered and reported and made transparent so that each side of this issue has a basis to go back to demonstrate that their perspective or their position is correct. And that's what we're talking about now in this bill or in any other language. We're no longer talking about a staffing model, so to speak. It's about gathering information and making it transparent. And that's what I was hoping that you would get to at this point in the beginning of the session. So to be still struggling about whether or not we need to do this transparency, maybe it's some language needs to be changed in order to allow the transparency to make more sense for how hospitals operate. But
the concept here is about gathering and reporting information so that each of you can demonstrate that your perspectives are correct. That's how I view this legislation. So I'm listening for why that's a bad idea. It sounds like it's a bad idea. I don't know if that's what you're saying to me or not.
Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Senator Rosen, then Senator Hoffman. We have one more testifier that I would like to. Maybe I'll have the testifier, and then we'll get some questions. Okay, great. Thank you. Dr. Brent Asplin.
Yeah, good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you. My name is Brent Asplin. I'm president of the Fairview Medical Group and also Fairview's chief clinical officer. And prior to my role at Fairview, I was chair of the departments of emergency medicine, both at the Mayo Clinic and at Regents Hospital here in St. Paul, and I'm a graduate of Mayo Medical School. I'm going to make my comments about the staffing ratio much more brief and then speak more to the amendment, since that's where we're at this afternoon. In 2006, the Institute of Medicine published three reports on the future of emergency care in the U.S. health system, and I was a member of the panel that created those three reports. And the number one safety issue that was identified by the Institute of Medicine in those reports when it comes to emergency care was the boarding of inpatients in hospital emergency departments across the country. Boarding occurs when a patient is admitted from the emergency department but remains in the emergency department, in some cases for days, waiting for a hospital inpatient bed, either because the bed does not exist or there's not staffing available to care for that patient. As it relates to the original language from a nurse staffing legislation that would speak to mandated ratios, I spoke with a colleague from San Diego, California, where similar legislation is in effect today. And she described a situation of gridlock in her emergency department where patients could not be moved back from the waiting room because every bed in the emergency room was filled with an inpatient who could not go to the hospital because of the nurse-mandated fixed staffing ratios. That's certainly an unintended consequence that I just would like the committee members to be aware of, that we certainly would not want to replicate here in Minnesota. We should continue to base our staffing decisions on the individual needs of patients. In Minnesota, that's helped create one of the best emergency care systems in the country, and we'd like to continue that. As it relates to the Delete All amendment today, I would make just four quick comments about why I would join my colleagues here in opposition to the Delete All amendment. And they relate to quality, transparency, teamwork, and our efforts in innovation and healthcare reform here in the state. I've had the pleasure and the opportunity to serve on four different steering committees at the National Quality Forum, the Steering Committee on Emergency Care, Committee on Care Coordination, the Committee on Hospital Readmission Policies, and currently on the NQF's Committee on Cost and Resource Use. And each time I've had the opportunity to reflect on where Minnesota sits compared to our peer states around the country. And in every instance of those steering committees, it has been rewarding to get on the plane and come back and know that Minnesota is ahead of the rest of the country in virtually all of the quality measures that the National Quality Forum was considering in each of those steering committees. So we are ahead. We have room to improve, and we continuously strive to improve, but we are ahead. From the standpoint of transparency, we have gems in this state related to our transparency around Minnesota community measurement, which certainly focuses more on the ambulatory setting than hospital inpatient, but that is a wonderful example of our dedication to transparency around how we are doing. Likewise, on hospitalcompare.gov, many of the hospital safety and quality measures that are articulated in the Delete All Amendment are already included, and anyone can go on the website and see how hospitals are performing on core safety and quality measures. In addition to that, we have the adverse health events reporting. I think that's one of the key reasons, speaking, Madam Chair, to your question, is that this appears to be duplicative to efforts that are already in place and, frankly, light years ahead of the rest of the country when it comes to transparency around patient safety and patient quality. From the standpoint of teamwork, I would say my experience in the emergency department is you absolutely rely on great teamwork to deliver good patient care. And a core part of that is having fantastic emergency nurses as partners on the team. But it goes beyond emergency nurses. You have to have great technicians, great pharmacists, great unit coordinators, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, housekeeping, to make that emergency department function in ways that are going to save lives and provide timely, high-quality care. And I know that's the same throughout the hospital. So we clearly do need to emphasize teamwork across a variety of disciplines, and this seems to focus too much, frankly, on the role of nursing, as important as that is, when it's the team that is going to result in better outcomes for our patients. And finally, when it comes to innovation, we at Fairview, along with the other systems that are represented here and those that aren't represented here, are dedicated to changing and reforming our delivery system so that we can deliver better value for the patients we serve and improve the health of the communities we serve. And it's that innovative spirit that, to me, is a hallmark of what healthcare reform and healthcare delivery reform is doing in the state of Minnesota. The current language that is before you on this issue, to me, is in many respects duplicative of things that we're already doing, would be distracting in some respects compared to other and, frankly, in my mind, more important reform efforts that will improve outcomes and control costs for our patients, and would be a step backwards. The end of the day and the bottom line is this. We can all be very pro-patient and pro-nursing and still oppose the language that's before you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Is there anyone else here that needs to testify? Okay, seeing none, I'll open. I saw that Senator Rosen and Senator Hoffman had questions. Senator Marty, Senator Nelson, Senator Benson. So we'll begin at the left and move all the way across. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Madam Chair, and folks for participating in this discussion. That seems to, the day I arrived was at my doorstep, and it's too bad it came to this doorstep when it should have been handled on a local level. And as saying that, I like, as of Friday, I've been watching this. And even Friday night, Madam Chair, the Minnesota Hospital Association put a tweet out saying that even though they disagree with one component of it, they agree with the transparency piece that this bill provides. So exactly where you're saying that this gets into that transparency part, and that's there to get good data collected to see what's next for us. And so, and even having said that, I seem a little confused because I, as a Friday night, it seemed like there was an agreement on language there, and now I'm not hearing that. I'm hearing that there's still that division. But having said that, I just wanted to validate what you were saying on the whole transparency piece, and I'm glad we can talk about transparency piece, and I'm also saddened that it came to us to now that we have to micromanage how what should be handled on a local level gets brought up here.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess to Senator Hoffman's comments, there was an agreement. I believe the House language is completely different than what the A6 amendment says. I think there are some components that are the same, but there are some components in there that are very troubling. And I have a few questions for Senator Hayden about that. And I think one of the Mr. Massey brought this up, this 7-7. That's an issue. Senator Hayden, how often does the core staffing plan have to be done in Subdivision 2? Is this something that is on a weekly basis? Is this something on a daily basis? They're required to, in paragraph B, consult with direct care staff, nurses, nursing managers, representatives, hospital managerial and medical staff, as well as quality assurance staff and other relevant hospital personnel about the core staffing plan and expected average number of patients upon which a staffing plan is based. And so if this is happening on a daily basis or even a weekly basis, you can imagine how complicated this is going to be and the cost of doing business for this hospital is going to go up? That's my one of my first questions, Madam Chair.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Rosen. I'm going to bring Ms. Cunningham back up to talk about some of the detailed questions of it. But I think that what we were getting at, and you know, and if I may, Madam Chair, there seems to be
Senator Hayden.
Kind of differences of opinion about what happened in the House of Representatives. I know we don't spend a lot of time talking about what happened there. That was an arrangement, I guess I could loosely call it, that came pretty quickly over there. And frankly, Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, you know, almost as much as when that bill got passed, both sides were saying that it wasn't quite what they wanted. So I had the Hospital Association, frankly, saying that there were big provisions in there that they didn't like. This is of the House version. And then ultimately the Minnesota Nurses Association said that there were things that they thought needed to be more robust. Speaking of your particular question, and we'll get into the details, I think what we're trying to get at here, and if it doesn't work the way that it should or if it's overburdensome, I guess we'll figure that out. But we're trying to kind of do a deeper dive on this issue. So we're trying to do it shift by shift. We're trying to ensure that when we look at this issue, we're not looking at it always in the aggregate, whatever that may be, yearly, every 6 months. We're trying to look at this because what we're hearing from nurses, which is sometimes different than what we hear from the hospitals, is that things are happening in a dynamic way, and we're trying to figure out what happens on the night shift, the swing shift, the day shift. How do those staffing trends differ? For example, you might be okay during the day, but you might not be okay at night. And when you look at those in the aggregate, now, once again, I'm not an expert in this, but this is the kind of thing that we're hearing. So I just wanted to get, I mean, we can get to a more detailed issue, but I wanted to kind of address the overall kind of what happened between now and then kind of why we're starting to do a deeper dive in some of these issues.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, to that point, and Senator Hayden, I do appreciate your work on this, but as Senator Hoffman said, there was, quote, an agreement that came out of the House. And if there is an agreement and all of a sudden there is an amendment that completely is completely different to what came out of the House as far as an agreement, we are working very hard on trying to do it in this committee what we thought was already done, and I know there's a lot of work that needs to be done by this policy committee. So I'm very concerned about that. I do know in the House's amendment, the core staffing plan means the projected number of full-time equivalent non-managerial care staff that will be assigned in a 24-hour period. So this is something that needs to be done on a daily basis, and they have to go back and check with in paragraph B, the representatives of the hospital, managerial, medical staff, the direct care staff, nurses, nursing managers. I mean, the layer of work that we are putting on in subdivision 2, that's just one part of this amendment that really needs to be worked on, because we're adding a lot of work here.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm going to let the Nurses Association talk about this a little bit, but I do want to address Senator Rosen, because I think that this is something that needs to be said, that the Minnesota Hospital Association, after the so-called agreement, came to me and they had a lot of things that they wanted to be changed. The Minnesota Nurses Association came with what's in front of you. And the reason why I want to make that clear, I brought this bill on behalf of the Minnesota Nurses Association, and we're moving that forward. So whatever agreement that was made clearly didn't work for either party, because both parties came with significant changes to the so-called agreement. And I just want to make sure that that's clear, so it doesn't skew it one way or the other, that there has been changes, that both groups came to me looking for significant changes in what apparently was done in the House.
But Madam Chair,
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But Senator Hayden, the press release that came out from the Minnesota Nurses is on March 15th is negotiations between the MNA and the MHA resulted in an agreement that recognizes the crisis of patient safety and creates a plan to add transparency to patient care. So that's what we had. We had an agreement, and maybe it wasn't fully comfortable with both of them, but that's kind of the same as a conference committee. You end up taking things that you not necessarily care for going forward. But here, this A6 amendment is a hospital has a bottom line. They are a business. I don't think they're in the business to compromise patients' wellness or safety. And so I think with just this, the core staffing plan, the quality report website, and then you have to go, then you go back and tell the hospital association that they shall confer with the Minnesota Nurses Association as far as the website, so they have to get it okayed by the MNA that they can put up what they can put up on their website, and then you go back and then you have to study it, which is a massive, massive study. And I really do think that we're going to have to bring in the department to find out if they can even do this study. So I think a study is a wonderful way to look at this, if that's what the agreement was. But to do this massive of a study is a problem.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen.
Senator Hayden.
I am going to let Ms. Cunningham talk in a minute about the press release and others, but I want to continue to reiterate that I could have brought a delete all that the Minnesota Hospitals Association wanted, and then the other side would have said, hey, I thought we had an agreement. There clearly was something that went on in the House of Representatives that both groups did not care for. That is very clear to me. So I just want to put that, you know, for the record. We're moving forward with this. The ideal of this is to put to make the staffing plan a little more robust. And then for the plan, in the House's version, we felt like the language was not specific enough in terms of giving the Department of Health direction on what to study. We can have a conversation on if this is too much or onerous. I think that that is absolutely fair. I just wanted to just try to give you some sense of what really happened all weekend long when I took calls from both sides, and then also why some of this stuff language is here, especially in the study with respect of giving the Department of Health some direction. I would like Ms. Cunningham to address a couple of your questions, Senator Rosen, as well as whatever you know press release and information that they sent out.
Ms. Cunningham?
Chairwoman Sharon, Senator Rosen, the intent for Subdivision 2, where hospitals will need to submit their core staffing plan, Subdivision 2 requires that they submit the core staffing plan. And then if you look down under Subdivision 3 in consumer transparency, it asks that they update it if there are any changes on a quarterly basis. That's our intention. If the language is unclear, we're certainly open to clarifying that, but that's always been our intention, that it would be a quarterly thing. We know that hospitals do, for most hospitals do, some sort of core staffing plan, and so we're just asking that that be reported to both the commissioner and be open for consumers of healthcare to be able to have that. If you'd like, I could also respond to questions about the hearing on Friday.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to make an oral amendment, but I also just want to say that out of 91,000 RNs, MNA only has about 19,000. So I don't think this is going to represent all the nurses in the state, and I want to make that very clear and put that on the record. With that, I'd like to make an oral amendment to strike Subdivision 4, the study, and add the language, MDH shall convene a work group to study the correlation between nurse staffing levels and patient outcomes. This report shall be presented to the chairs of ranking minority members of the Health and Human Services Committees in both the House and the Senate by January 15th of 2015. And I think, Madam Chair and Senator Hayden, if you don't mind, I mean, this is a huge report. I would assume we probably would be asking the MDH to absorb the cost on this, but I don't see how you could do that. And I actually really agree with what the chair was saying, that we already have quality measures in place. that can verify a lot of what you're asking in this study. I think moving forward, again, I really appreciate your work on this, but I think this A6 amendment is a step backwards in many ways. It would be nice to have supported the a study going forward and some agreement.
Senator Lurie, this is now on the amendment.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, is that the study language that was developed House. In the House? Is mm-hmm. that correct?
Right.
I mean, we're, Madam Chair, we're just about at the end of our committee time here, and truthfully, I didn't, you know, I saw the House language too, but I saw it Friday afternoon. I didn't bring a copy with me. I would actually like some time to dig into this a little bit. I know we had some time set aside this morning to do so, but everybody was delayed because of the snowstorm. I mean, I think I noticed we only have two bills on our agenda this evening. Before we adopt any amendments, I'd actually appreciate it if we had some time to further look at what the House had, what we have before us, you know, as members engage in a little more fully.
Thank you, Senator Lurie. I should say that it's up to sure. Senator Rose if she wants to withdraw her amendment at this time.
I'll table my amendment.
Or table your amendment. Sure. Mm-hmm. But the time has come very short, and it was anticipated on my part that I would table this. Senator Hayden encouraged a tabling of this with the idea that we could continue the conversation this evening. But I want you to know that I'm also willing to table it and have it come up a little later in the week because it is my expectation that we're going to lay it on the table, I guess, rather than table. Lay it on the table. It may pull it back up and then lay it on the table again because we were caught with a delete all amendment this morning. Everybody was caught with a delete all amendment. And we're all a little unclear as to how it's different than the House language. And it's not that we have to follow the House language. The Senate court can do its own work. But we were led to believe that there was an agreement met between the parties. And if that's not the case, then we may be back to a struggle that's very difficult for us to resolve here. We're hoping it's resolved there. So,
Madam Chair.
If you, yes, Senator Hayden.
Well, let me say this. I am more than willing to the chair's prerogative and also Senator Lurie and Senator Rosen. I think that is a good idea. This has moved pretty fluidly, and there has been significant changes, and I think it might bear out to lay this on the table. And even if we do that and do it later in the week, I think that might be helpful. The hearing was scheduled, and we all knew that it had to happen, and so we had to kind of put our best foot forward. But if there is an opportunity for parties to get together and figure out if there's a way to come to some consensus, I've been more than willing to do that this whole session on this particular bill. But it was set, and now was the time to move, and this is what I thought was the best language. But I'm more than willing to lay this bill on the table, and I would request that we at least take it up before the end of the week. But if we need a couple of more days to work on that, I'm more than willing to do so.
Senator Nina.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a procedural question. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think right now we still have the A6 amendment before us, or did we adopt that?
We've adopted the A6 amendment.
Okay.
It was a delete all amendment.
Madam Chair, if I
Senator
may.
Senator Hayden, let me talk with you. We can lay it on the table and pick it back up this evening if you think that you would have time for the parties to get together or to come back with something that is responsive to the concerns. And if you can't and you want to come forward with a bill and then just ask us to vote on it, we would be willing to do that. If you think you have time to accomplish that by tonight's meeting, then that's what we'll do. If not, we'll try to schedule it in later in the week. I would ask you for your guidance.
The only question I have is the path. Originally, this bill was headed to state government, but I don't think that as we the delete all or some formation of the delete all where we've taken out the committees, I don't think that it has to go there anymore. And I know Senator Lurie has requested it in finance, and so we're okay with that. So I just want to
Senator Rosen, Madam Chair, there is a work group on page 2.22, so I would assume that would make it required to go to state up with the worker. Mm-hmm.
Even if it's not legislators?
So.
Even if it's not legislators on it?
I think if there are no legislators. Chair, we can get clarity on whether or not it would need to go to another policy committee, and in talking with Senator Pappas, and be aware that we do need to meet deadline, I think, and still come back. And if it's laid on the table, it's laid on the table, whether we take it up tonight or Wednesday. And I know that state and local has a hearing on Friday. I believe I have a bill or two up in it, and maybe they
Let's
can
do that.
Extend it. So, I mean, I think if you lay it on the table, we'll be able to work all this out and make sure that we have the best language.
I'm anticipating that we will pick it up tonight. I'm going to make a motion that we lay this bill on the table.
Yes, lay it on the table.
Madam Chair, do I need to make a motion to table my oral amendment?
Yes.
Did I? Yes. No, you withdrew it. I thought you withdrew your
amendment.
Your amendment.
I did.
Table.
You
or tabled
okay.
it.
No, you tabled laid it on the table. It's on the table.
Can I?
So I guess that's it. We're done. It's laid on the table. Are you clear? We've laid this on the table. I intend to take it up this evening, just for your information, to get some conversations going now. We will recess until 6 p.m. To meet in room 112, room 112, tonight at 6 p.m.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Pretty.
Not controversial.
I didn't think there was